I'm still smoking like Skip.
She can't have no beard, man.
She does, though, man. She blew my mind, right? Is so far out? Is there dope far out? I don't know. Oh, man. In Denmark, they get hash for a dollar. For a dollar a gram.
Is legal, right?
No.
That's what somebody told me.
True. I think it is, yeah.
Possession ain't legal in Denmark, so illegal in Afghanistan and Nepal.
It's pretty much legal. They don't enforce it. Yeah. At all. Right. Yeah, it's in the subway. Everybody sleeps in the subway. And the subways are nice. Yeah.
Really?
Subways are nice. Oh, yeah, they're beautiful. They're nice. They're clean. They're easy to get around. I didn't have no trouble getting around when I was over there by myself, even. Yeah, and there's no crime in the streets, like you could travel around at night and not be afraid at all. It's really far out. But what they've got over there, they've got social democracy, and it really produces apathy among the people. Like the whole country of Sweden is united against the war, you know? But they still have relations, they still belong to NATO, and they still have relations with the U.S., and it gives this whole, yeah, exactly, because it gives this whole feeling of well-being. It's like a welfare state, right? So it feels like that everybody's cool and everybody thinks that there's no hungry people there, and the people who are hungry would never come out and say it because they're too embarrassed about it.
Really?
Yeah, it's like Jan was saying, that like in Denmark, they could never do a free breakfast for children program because no parents would ever admit that their children were hungry.
Jesus, really?
Yeah.
Never admit that you're poor.
Right. Because it's a welfare state that's supposed to be socialist. Yeah, but that's not because of a welfare state. That's because of their pride. Right. Yeah, sort of. Yeah. But anyway, so it's like when I went to two places to speak in front of large audiences. Like one place was in like this cinema. It was a theater, and there was a rock and roll band that played, and I spoke, and Connie Matthews spoke, and Victor spoke.
Who's Connie Matthews?
She's the international organizer for the Black Panther Party. That's another whole thing I got to tell you about. This is in Denmark. I'll say real quickly what I was going to say. While you're talking to these people, they nod their heads, and they hear everything you say, and they clap, but there's no follow-up. They do no action beyond that. They have more information in Denmark than any European country about the Black Panther Party, about everything that's going on over here, but they do very, very little action with people because they're all just so apathetic and so opiated or something, you know? They drink a lot of beer, a whole lot of beer, and they don't get particularly drunk. You know?
I'm sure.
I'm sure that's part of it, yeah. Yeah, right. And it was like they came to us for entertainment, you know, rather than to do any kind of action.
Did you make any porn with you?
No. They got porn all over the place, too, man. You open up their papers, their daily papers, and there's tits all over the place.
Really?
Yeah, and
no
even
cocks,
in the...
Though,
even in... No cocks. In the subway, there's tits. There's even tits in the subway.
Yeah, I'll go with you.
And there's porn stores, you know. You go walk down a street and there's a porn store, and they got all their
like
displays, you know. I've never been on 42nd Street, I don't know.
People have certain if you've gone to Marquette, you talk to the people up in Marquette, I mean, they carry the weight of their environment, which is the very cold weather, and the hard work. And because of that, they just don't have the leisure class ideas and social practice that we have here.
Yeah, I always talk about Connie Matthews and the Black Panther Party. They're really running the whole thing of the class war or the race war. Really pissed off about the conspiracy. Really pissed off about the whole white left in America because so much of it is Jewish, and there's so that Zionist question is a really heavy question.
Why are they pissed off about the conspiracy?
Well, because they feel that nobody got out. Dave Dellinger was the only person who did anything when Bobby Seale
was... I
want
to talk about that later.
Okay.
I'll let you finish, because that's something we talked about with Aiden. So
okay, good. I'm glad, because I don't know their story about it. But the Black Panthers feel that when Fred Hampton and Mark Clark were shot, and when Bobby Seale was bound and gagged, that there was very little reaction in the mother country because of that. But when the seven were convicted and put into jail, the whole country blew up and burned. And they're really pissed off about it. And they say that the white left is either going to get its shit together, and there's going to be a class war, or the white left, or they say they're going to do it alone, and it'll be a race war.
Should we talk about that now? Or should we do it later? Because you might as well finish your whole... I was thinking maybe you should finish your whole thing first.
Let's talk about it.
No, let's go ahead.
All right, well, that was the whole thing we got into with Hayden. And he ran down a couple of things.
And he said that right from the start, that Charles Geary, right when the trial started, that Charles Geary... He was pissed off because he couldn't get the trial postponed because he saw it essentially as Bobby Seale on trial and nobody else. It was Bobby Seale's trial, period. Mm-hmm. And then he advised Bobby Seale from the very beginning that since he couldn't be there, and not to let Kunstler represent him. He said there was this whole big thing between Kunstler and Geary, who was going to be, you know, the lawyer and what image, you know, the Panther lawyer, that kind of thing. That he advised Bobby Seale right at the beginning not to do what he did, to, you know, just to, you know, bring it up in court. And as it got heavier and heavier, he just kept urging him on. And that Bobby Seale did not want support. It was his show. He made it very clear at their meetings and stuff that it was his show, that he was going to stand up and do this, and for the rest of them, you know, not to upstage him. And the whole thing, that the day that the thing happened in the courtroom, the day Bobby was, not only bound and gagged, but the day that he was sentenced to contempt, the courtroom was like half full of Black Panthers. And he instructed them before he came out that, you know, it was going to be heavy and to cool it. They obviously didn't do anything. They didn't react in any way whatsoever. They didn't get up and shout or anything like that. And that it was just very clear all along that that's exactly what Bobby wanted, but they did not want them to react, that they felt if they did that, that it would, you know, remove from his thing as being his trial. And the thing about, you know, TDA, you know, about the whole thing with people burning down the country and everything, they organized that for like 4 months previous to the trial, like in the third or fourth month of the trial, they started organizing that and making phone calls and setting up committees and doing everything. So it wasn't spontaneous. It was out in the press. People knew about it. It was a planned thing, which obviously Bob or Fred Hampton was.
Fred Hampton and Mark Clark is mine as much as anything else, I'm sure.
That's not too. But the thing is the way the Panthers come off it now and say, well, you know, look at this and look at that. But the thing is, they try and portray this TDA as just a total spontaneous thing, which it wasn't. I know for a fact it wasn't in Ann Arbor because it was, you know, talked about like at least a month ahead of time. And, you know, you saw the literature all over the country. It was a very well planned thing, and it was just a thing to instill in everybody's consciousness. Well, when this happened, this is what we do, you know, and that. That they had as much Bobby Seale in mind as everybody else, of course, but, you know, that it just came off because he was removed from the trial. They could have done it. He said they had some alternatives. I mean, they could have stopped the trial, just refused to let the trial go on, just to make Hoffman declare a mistrial for everybody and start all over again. And if they did that they would just be in jail the whole time, no bail, and that they couldn't have gone around the country and spoke, and that was part of the thrust of the whole trial, was the fact that they got around to go around and really make people relate to it, and that they had, you know, in this way that they would have been totally confined. They couldn't prepare a defense like they did. They couldn't have, speak around the country, and that would have been fucked that way if they tried to do that. But the main thing is that that's not what the Panthers wanted. That's not what Charles Geary wanted, and you know, that's the way it turned out. So
yeah,
it just seems really unfair that now all of a sudden they're pulling this shit down. Should I go into that Cheney press conference now?
I was just going to say that the statement, you know, it came from Eldridge, and maybe he didn't know all of that, and that the Panthers so much follow Eldridge that maybe they've just forgotten all that. They haven't seen that. They don't know that.
Maybe that's true that happened, but maybe we should have realized that it was wrong. And we should have done it.
So much.
Right.
We're in the trial.
Yeah. Oh, I don't. I mean, we collectively, we are white people, white revolutionaries, should have done it.
Well, that's like an idealistic kind of statement to make. I mean, it ain't practical. We didn't know what was going on in the trial.
Yeah, but you can see how it looks.
The thing to do is politically, man, the thing to do if someone's getting ripped off at a trial, that's not the time to act, man, when someone gets ripped off right then in the courtroom, man.
Well, I don't know about that.
What do you mean?
Well, all I'm saying...
Back then, because that's when you have access to the media. See, that's what the Panthers' main bitch about is that we let the media define the TDA action as one in behalf of seven white defendants instead of defining it as one in behalf of all those things that have gone down, man. All our gut reaction stuff to Fred Hampton, to Bobby Seale, plus the seven white defendants. We didn't define how the media covered it. Therefore, it was, you know, it was a racist thing because that's the way...
That's the way
people,
it came up.
People know what they hear.
And that's the way it came off, that nothing happened when Bobby and Mark and Fred were killed, but then after the seven were put, I mean, that's the way, that's what happened, and that's the way some, but some, most people don't know the behind the scenes thing,
yeah, but I would think
right?
they would want it that way in many ways.
Would want what way?
In the way that nothing would happen behind those things.
Why? So,
except the Panthers, except in terms of education for the masses. I mean, they wouldn't want to have rebellions, et cetera, where more black people get ripped off
well,
and fucked up.
Well, maybe the way it's happened now is even better, because it's forcing, you know, maybe the left will be forced to start to understand their racism, because nobody emphasizes racism enough,
that's,
you know?
That's what I'm saying.
You can't emphasize racism enough.
It could
enough.
Have been a political maneuver so that they would be in a position
to
turn the white left. And the so-called movement to be racist, which it is in reality, and calls for some very serious get downing, man.
Right,
whether you're either racist,
see,
punk,
really
man.
See, they're
looking
at us now. They're really looking at the White Panther Party. The Black Panther Party is really looking at the White Panther Party now. Mm-hmm. We found out that at the, remember the media conference, the first media conference in Ann Arbor, Big Man came out, and when he went back, he had some very good things to say about us. He said we were still very naive and we didn't have very much political understanding, but that he was really impressed with us, and that we must be, he said we must have something together because we're really getting repressed by the pigs, right? So that was one thing. Also, when we spoke with Connie Matthews, she spent some time with us, a couple hours with us for 2 days to talk with us, to see where we were at before she decided whether she would even speak on the same platform with us or not. That's how pissed off they are. They're really, really pissed off about the white left. And when she spoke, that's exactly what she talked about, was the racism and Zionism of the left movement, and how that she said that what they felt that a lot of the left was Zionist, and that it was a Zionist judge that sentenced the seven to jail.
That ain't the American left.
Well, I know that. Well, it's not all.
I mean,
of
Zionism.
It.
What the fuck?
Yeah, of course, but I mean, I don't understand, I mean, how they can call the American left Zionist.
I think my experience in the movement, I've seen, like, there were a lot of Jewish people within the left for a long time, and they were making a lot of decisions.
Yeah, I agree.
The white left has never come out and made a definite side with the Arab people. Nobody has ever done that. Well, they have had to, because it has never been decided. It's been a very, very touchy situation.
Who pulled up and split. I mean, they never even made the Rim 1, Rim 2 split. They went right to Israel to go and fight, you know? That's a reality. I mean, they did, huh?
There weren't a lot of them.
I know five or six people from Detroit.
That's really sad.
But that was like, you know, so long. I mean, we got to deal with...
It has been that way all along.
Right.
It hasn't become Zionist overnight.
We ain't saying no, we can't change it.
See, the thing, I brought back 3 tapes. See, another meeting I had was with a journalist from one of the Danish liberal papers, and he had just come back from Jordan, I guess, and I brought back 3 tapes, and one is with a young 24-year-old gorilla up in the mountains living in a cave with like 25, a band of gorilla in Jordan, I guess. Is that, where would the Arabs be? Jordan, right. Right. He'd be there in Jordan. They live up in this cave up in the mountains, and that's where the interview takes place.
And he says,
yeah, it's in English.
We got a transcript and put it in the paper.
I'm here. Let me tell you, I got 3 tapes. He's a young dude, and he's just like us. It's so far out. They're running the same fucking things that we run about. They talk about the need for theory and practice. I mean, they're total Marxists is what they are. They're just beautiful because they talk about the need for theory and practice, and how they have collective education meetings, political education classes, where they talk about the fact that there's no teacher-student relationship, that it's all collective education. and they talk about their situation there and their lifestyle living up there in that cave, and they talk about actions, you know, the actual guerrilla actions when they go out and they have to cross the river and do all this stuff, and it's just this young dude, and he's just, it's really beautiful. That's the most beautiful of the three. I got another one with a dude from Al Fat. Oh, and the dude, well, that isn't how this other dude says it. Al Fatah, that's how we say it. He says it Al Fat. He just got back. So. But anyway, he talks, he gives an introduction to it and said, before we, the interviewer who I talked to in Denmark, in Copenhagen, talks about the interview that he's giving beforehand. And he runs down that there's like 12 different groups down there, all doing different things, and they're not all together. They're just like us. Yeah, was it? Yeah, far out. Good. Did they run down the 12 different groups? Far out. Well, the... I left. I went to New York, right, and I saw Jerry. Yeah, and I saw Jerry just for about 10 minutes, and I started talking to him about how we wanted to get our whole thing together, and I ended up just by saying something like, you know, if we can't work totally on a total together level, then at least when you have something planned, let us know about it, and we'll promote it too, and we'll do the same for you. When we have something planned, then you help promote it too, and that was like a real shallow level. But then by the time I split, he was like saying, well, come back and talk to me when you get back in New York. And it was on a really friendly level, and it sounded like we were really going to get together. One of the things that we did in Stockholm was Judy and Nancy and Victor Coleman. Victor Coleman is an underground White Panther field marshal. Does everybody understand?
Mm-hmm.
Good friend of all of ours.
Yeah. John, you know what John said about that? And I knew that guy would be good for something someday.
Oh, far out. Far out. Victor Coleman is a printer and a poet in from Toronto, Coach House Press. Does everybody understand that?
Yeah.
Okay. So it was Judy. And
that makes a little slow.
He just didn't know. That's all right. It's let's see. It was Judy and Nancy and Victor and myself. We had a meeting in a room. We didn't hardly go to none of the conference anyway. It was a bullshit conference. We had a meeting about what we were going to do about the Youth International Party White Panther Coalition and how we were going to treat it from now on. And we talked for a while, and then when it really got down was when the North Vietnamese dude came in, and Wong came in, and Bob Greenblatt. Now this is, I gotta tell you about Bob Greenblatt. He's really a groovy dude. He's really far out. He's a professor, and he now relates totally to the White Panthers. And he's in New York. He's really, really good dude. He was in the Moog. He's been in the Moog, active in the Moog up to now, but he's ready to move on to something more revolutionary. He's really a far-out dude that everybody hears. We really got to relate to him. I hope he'll come out to Ann Arbor. But what we decided, the outcome of the whole meeting was that that what we have, the main thing that has to be done now is that we've got to unite the left, and we've got to build a broad, broad base among the youth and among all the left-oriented people. But within that, we also have to have a revolutionary organized party, which has got to be the White Panther Party. So what's going to happen is that there's going to be a small, a small group of people from different organizations, like one person from the White Panther Party, one person representing Youth International Party, and any other groups that we can get to go around and talk to all groups that we can think of, like the Seattle Liberation Front, Moog, you know, anybody we can think of, Yeah, and get them to relate, yeah, to the Youth International Party, and try to get everybody, as many people as we can, to build a really broad base. This is the same thing that they've done in North Vietnam, is they have the Federation, which is like a, you know, which has a broad base thing, which includes all the youth groups and all the different groups, and then within that they have the League, which is the organized political revolutionary party. Within that.
Is there any structural differences between the Youth International Party and White Panther Party?
To be a member of the Youth International Party, we figured the only criteria would be you'd be anti-fascist, anti-imperialist, and anti-racist. You know, and that anybody can, you know, who can relate to that can be a member of the Youth International Party. In other words, there won't be any written kept books and shit like that. We don't have to necessarily. No, they don't either. Frank also don't. Right? But see, then the criterion for belonging to the White Panther Party, of course, is much higher than that. One of the things I really want to do is like really get really, really tight and maybe bring down our chapter list, maybe down to 10, maybe 10 chapters, and make a distinction between functioning chapters and Panthers in training. You know? Like. No, the Federation. It'll be a federation. But see, the thing is that they still, like Nancy and Judy and certain people, still don't want to relate to the White Panther Party as being a vanguard party. You know, they still just try to find ways to get around it and not, you know, and not.
Well, what is
not
the vanguard
believe.
White Party? What is the vanguard White Party?
There isn't one. That we'll have like a mass meeting of different representatives from all the groups of in the Youth International Party, and I think they're hoping that another whole party will come out of it.
You're saying really, it seems bizarre to me because I relate to the Vanguard Party more than I relate to an umbrella organization, and if our organizing activities are going to be.
No, that's the thing. What I said was that one person. From the White Panther Party will be involved in organizing the Federation. One person, we were thinking maybe it should be Skip. And he would go around with like Bob Greenblatt and maybe Judy or Nancy and some other people, a couple of other people, and spend their time traveling, going to different groups and spending time with them to talk to them and try to get, you know, some kind of federation because it's super important. It just really blew my mind to be out of the United States and look on it. You know, from Europe, everybody is watching us. Everybody. It's incredible. And they were so impressed with the White Panther Party. It just blew my mind. They were really impressed with us. First of all, being at the conference was a bullshit conference.
Why is that?
Because it was all liberals and...
table talk, you know, those dirty hippies and those dirty niggas.
You know, even the little kids that like we've seen it. As I'm talking about, like if 13, if we play a Sunday afternoon gig, 13-year-old kids, they can really we can really see that they're being able to really decide, you know, what's
fascinating to us. But the way we look at it, man, the revolution. I don't know in what terms everybody considers what the revolution is, but to us, the revolution started in 1957 when people found out that you could have a good time, and it started with something that's inside of everybody, as far as we're concerned, everybody in the world. It's so universal that rock and roll is right there. Everybody takes some a little longer to bring it out than others, you know, but everybody's got it in them, and that's why it hit the whole world by storm way back in 1957, you know, and now it's progressed into this music that is so complicated that even some of the people that are playing it can't understand it. And when you sit there and you listen to it, you have to concentrate and figure out what the hell's going on in order to understand what this man is trying to say, which is really good if you
this
want to be able to tell
this
it.
This isn't negative.
You know,
these people are relating, you know, what they're doing, the way they're looking at it, and we're relating the way we're looking at it.
The way we look
see?
At it is,
and their interpretation is not only, you know, we'll say their interpretation is not only equal, you know, but it's necessary, you know. It's really necessary.
We're talking about other groups.
Oh, other
groups. You know, this isn't our thing, but it's turned out that it's opposed.
So
rock and roll music, 57 rock, and then there's everything else.
No.
We've gone through a whole phase from 1957 until 1970,
retro.
1969. See, we've gone through this whole thing, and the revolution started in 57. That's when people started, you know, that's when they started getting rowdy. That's when they started thinking, because, man, they were letting it out. They had been holding all this stuff inside of them for so many years, and rock and roll was the way they got it out of them, right? Okay, so now we say, let's refresh, let's go back, and let's start what the old artists could do.
You know, we heard what the old artists were into, and they were so far into it, and we just figured that we were there then. See, we were all into rock and roll then, as
let's
everybody
give them the
was
enthusiasm
when we were kids.
That started the revolution, not just
and
carrying it
we
out.
And we wanted to play
it
too,
you know?
And that was even... We figured that we were even more lucky because we could play it from 1970, knowing everything we know now, in a 57 thing.
Mm-hmm.
The original.
So happy.
And make it
to us.
Sound like it did then.
Yep. One thing, you know, we don't want to give it the 1970 thousands of amplifiers. You know, thing. We wanna give it the heaviness it had back then, and the heaviness came not in the form of the music that was being played, but the vibes of the guys that were playing it. That they got everybody going so much. You know, the vibes were so good that that's our whole thing with 57 Rock. We enjoy it so much. Our practice sessions, you know, is like playing at Olympia for 20,000 people. It's just we just get into it so far mainly because we enjoy it so much. So we found something that's inside of everybody, and it gets people going. We think, you know, if they can get into it, if they can come down off of what they already know about music, you know, of what they hear on the radio every day. You turn on ABX, you hear a thing, man, that like just completely flips you out, you know. You can't figure out what's this guy trying to get at in that. Now they've got to hear, "I need your baby," you know, "Come on, let's have a ball, let's have some fun tonight," you know. And they, you know, it's such a Jesus Christ, man. That's pretty simple, you know. I mean, it's pretty simple to understand what they're trying to do. Now there must be some catch to it, and pretty soon they're gonna find that there ain't no catch. We're just nuts, you know. That's all. We're not trying to put no fake on anybody. I don't think we could if we wanted to. You know, the kids are much too intelligent today, you know, to try to put something over on. We just want to have a good time. And so our complaint is that the police...
hear rock and roll.
Don't want us to.
We go in the old zone. It's like...
why don't we just go play a record downstairs, you know? I got some fine records.
Yes,
you know,
like, we just sit around and listen to these oldies every day, because it keeps you in the spirit.
And you don't have to, it's like a meditative thing, because you don't have to think real far.
I'm going
to
go.
You don't have to think real far to get into old rock and roll, but it takes you up anyway, you know.
It
takes you right up anyway.
You can concentrate on other things besides the music when you're playing it. You know, it's so easy to do. You can concentrate on other crazy things like drinking a bottle of wine or smoking a joint. Some of the more heavier things, you know. But we enjoy it so much. and we feel that, you know, that's not a crime to go ahead and play 57 rock and roll. But you know, the pigs understand it more than the kids. They understand what's going on. They say, Jesus Christ, here these guys are starting it again, you know. Starting that goddamn revolution all over again, you know. And the second time, man, you know, will probably be the last, you know what I mean? Like, the second time is going to go right out into the zone, man, because the kids are just going to be so completely freaked out. And, like, I was reading in the paper the other day, flipping me out, said, this astrologist said that the reason why we're pacifists now is because we were all born, the generation born between 1957, no less, 1957 and the generation born between 1942 and 1957 are all pacifists. They're all, because Neptune was in Libra at the time, you know. Now, the generation born between 1957 and 1972, Neptune is in Scorpio, and these people better watch out, man. They're supposedly bloodthirsty, crazed maniacs. And you can see it in these little kids, you know.
No, we don't believe it, though.
We just though. We just like to, you know, get into this because it's really heavy. Now, 1957, Neptune just happened to jump into Scorpio, man, and we're flipping out. Because that's, to us, that's when it all started, you know. That's when people started getting down. So there must be some kind of truth to it, you know. It's like really, really something, man. These people are, you know, people of today are much crazier than they were, you know. Got their heads really crazed, mixed up.
Spoke about how, I mean, he talked about Zionism and how they don't, it's just like the way the black people say that they don't hate all white people. He was saying how they don't hate all Jews. He said, we accept Jews into, you know, to fight with us. So I guess they have some Jews that are fighting with them, you know. So that really cuts down that whole Zionist thing, you know. Cause,
what is
Zionism? Zionism is for imperialism.
Jewish state.
Huh?
Palestine should be the Jewish state of Israel.
See, what happened was
Zionism means exactly that. The Arab state of Palestine should become the Jewish state of Israel.
Provincial imperialism.
Tell the history, because
yeah.
The history.
Yeah, tell the history.
Yeah, did they run that down too? Did you?
I think so, yeah. That the Arabs were living there first, and then the Jews chose that as their chosen land and moved in and colonized the Arab people and made that their state. It's like imperialism.
Well, the British set it up.
Okay.
What's Israel then?
Israel is a Jewish state. In 1909.
Israel is trying to make a state. Not trying to make a religion.
Right.
In 1909. Yeah, but isn't there right now a country called Israel and a country called Palestine?
No, Palestine
was the area.
Sucked up.
Palestine was the area, but after the government was, like after the UN was maneuvered to a point where Britain and the United States and other countries wanted to lay this land on them, you know, they did
they
it.
They bought the land, too.
They bought the land through the UN and American and Britain, you know,
United
control
States
of the planet.
United States in the early part of the century to create a wedge in the Arab countries, took the state of Palestine and turned it over to European Jews, man, to create a state of Israel, which became a state in 1948. Mm-hmm. And between those years, in the early part of the century, in 1948, all the Jews in Europe started migrating to Israel. Every synagogue and every Jewish educational center throughout the world spread the gospel of Zionism, is that this is our land, you know, you should die in Israel. So that 1948, when the United Nations created a state, man, all the Jews were ready to go in there and
See,
take it over,
racist.
And that's exactly what happened.
Exactly.
At that point, Palestinians, many of whom were Jews, and the Palestine Jews are not in control of their own country anyway. That should be made clear, is that
the
people that run Israel are Europeans and Americans who have gone over there, man, and kicked out the natives of that land.
We also build the high rises that look just like the ones here in Ann Arbor. Shopping centers and all that garbage, man. It's really plastic.
Now, the Palestinian people, and at that point, 1948, were not assimilated into their neighboring countries of Egypt and Jordan and Syria and Saudi Arabia.
They were just being taped?
They were put in camps along the border so that the fascist governments of Arab countries, man, used the Palestinian people as pawns in their war with Israel, never letting the Palestinians arm themselves, educate themselves, build their own homes. They've been kept in tents since 1948 until El Fatah and its affiliated organizations, and many of whom came to the United States to become educated, starting working directly with the Palestinian people, their own people, for their own land.
Now, is El Fatah presently in Palestine?
No, they're
everywhere.
They're a guerrilla organization, man, that have bases in Egypt, Jordan, Syria, Lebanon, and are feuding with the governments of Syria. They can't hold more. Yeah, they pretty much control Jordan.
They originally came out, from what I understand, what I've read about it, I think in 1965 or 66, and they got all their guns in 1967 by going back out in the land that was captured by Israel and picking up the guns off the battlefield, you know. Then they started organizing, they started in Egypt. And in Egypt, they went through a 6 to 8 to 10 month repression where 25, maybe 50 members of the Fatah training crews were killed, ripped off, you know, until they gained support from the people.
Was this under Nasser?
Yeah, under Nasser, of course, yeah. And see, what happened was is they're promoting the ideas of power to the people.
Right.
And those things are not, you know, adaptable to the government because the government's such a bureaucracy, it's beyond all that.
Right.
So that happened there, and then they've been just heading, I don't know, I would say eastward, but now they're all the way up in Syria, you know, in Syria, and the government's in Beirut and Syria and everything, they oink like mad that Fatah have no place in our country and like all these statements in public. But like on the tube, while they're saying these statements, you can see them walking up and down the street with machine guns, man. Because they have the control of the people, and the leader of the Fatah, his pictures replaced Nasser's on many of the people's homes throughout the entire areas. Because of the program of serve the people and empower the people, and because it is effective, it's undermining all the governments in the area. The Arab governments and the Israeli governments.
The Egyptian government and the government of Saudi Arabia, in their war against Israel, want to return it to an Arab state, put in a plebiscite government, and Faisal from Saudi Arabia wants to capture those oil wells, man, for his own monarchy. And that's why they've prevented, man, the Palestinian people from organizing and educating themselves. That's why Al-Fatah is so important, man. That's why they almost overthrew the government of Syria.
Is Al-Fatah specifically a Palestinian movement?
Yes,
absolutely.
They're not totally Marxist-Leninists. They don't have a very definite, tight political line. That's another reason. Isn't that right? That's what. Yeah, right. They don't have it. That's one of the reasons. Yeah. And yeah, right, exactly. That's why they can attract so many large group of people.
I thought the split was who was going to be more communist than who, though, you said. You said like the
No, that was the split between the Popular Front and the Popular Democratic Front.
Well, you mean of all these 12 organizations, is Fatah is the biggest one, is
that? Yeah, right. And that's because they don't have...
Francis is communist.
Yeah, right. I mean, I'm not saying that, I'm not putting them down. I'm just saying that they don't have such a tight... See, it's the difference like between the Youth International Party and the White Panther. The Youth International Party is not going to have a definite, tight, organized political line, whereas the White Panther Party is going to be a very definitely Marxist-Leninist, a high criterion to be a member party. You know,
or else that's, it could be just like the fact of, you know, the White Panther Party serves the people and organizes programs to serve the people, and it doesn't, you know, by itself, it doesn't, you know, endorse all type of weird little acts. On the cover, they're against the armed struggle, and
they're
against the Popular Front action, against the real life blowing up, against terrorist acts.
No, they didn't claim to have done it, which just means it's the kind of statements we make, like we don't put it down.
No, they say
they are against the blowing up, the terrorist actions outside of their country.
It's more repression for them because outside the country,
because
media.
Bogus acts.
Yeah, right. It's because they believe it's bogus acts. They don't believe. Right, exactly. They don't believe in going out of the country and doing things they believe in doing acts within their country. I think the line of the White Panther Party is that we don't endorse terrorist actions, but we see them as a valuable gauge of the people's height of consciousness. And also, terrorism is just a step. Terrorism is a step to armed struggle. The next step from terrorism is to go into armed struggle.
Yeah, responsible terrorism. Right. I don't see the difference between endorsing it and saying it's far off.
We're not endorsing it. We say that we don't endorse it. We see it as we recognize it for what it is. What it is that, first of all, it's a gauge of the rage of the people, however you want to put it. It's a gauge to see how much of that is going on.
What, Jeannie Fish?
Is a gauge, and also the fact that terrorism is a step to armed struggle. It has been historically, it's a step to armed struggle.
There's a distinction between terrorism and sabotage that has to be made. The bombing of Standard Oil Company when the building is phoned and the people are cleared from the building is not a terrorist act. You know, the bombing of an airliner full of 44 Israelis and other people, you know, is a terrorist act. Tourists. Yeah, tourist buses and stuff. Right.
I don't understand. There's something I don't understand about Alpha Tau. You said there's two organizations called the Popular Democratic Front and the Popular Front. Where does Fatah fit in?
There's about 12 organizations down there.
Fatah is the largest. They do the most work, and they spend most of their time serving 90
Pakistanis. Some of them are just guerrilla bands, very small guerrilla bands, who don't do any propaganda.
What is the parallel with the International Party and the White Panther?
There's not really a real close parallel. The parallel I was trying to draw was between the fact that El Fatah doesn't have a definite political line, whereas some of the other groups do, and it's the same way the Youth International Party. What?
Their practice does, but they don't have to come out and say we're Marxist-Leninists. It's just like the Panthers were the thing about you ask any brother on the block if they're against communists, they say, damn right there, right? You say, what about the Breakfast Children program? What if he picks them down and rip them off? I'll shoot them, motherfuckers, right? So they relate to it in their everyday life, and they don't have to, you know. And because of it, the people still have petty bourgeois attitudes. Same thing in the American left.
People being Maoists, you know, and they make fun of other people when they're Maoists and Marxist-Leninists, you know.
Exactly.
And what we have to do, we really blew a lot of people's minds over there when we were over there, because here we were freaks running down Marxism-Leninism, you know, and that blew, and relating to Chairman Mao, yeah, sure.
Right on.
Hey. It's just, and that really blew, and it's the same thing is happening over here. That's what we've got to do over here.
Watch the uplift.
Did you offer many dope or hash or anything?
That's right, exactly.
What?
Exactly.
That's what I try to tell
what
the
is?
House.
Marxist-Leninism, yeah.
When the Black Panthers first started relating to us, they told us, see, we had all the practice, but we didn't have no theory. And they told us that if you're going to call yourselves revolutionaries, that means you're going to have to relate to the whole revolutionary, planetary revolution. And to do that, you have to be able to talk Marxist-Leninist theory. So we figured, I think that a lot of us started studying it thinking, you know, that we were learning the language of Marxism-Leninism. And then all of a sudden we realized, God damn, it's the same fucking thing that we're doing, right on, you know. And we learned the theory after we had already had the practice. So now we have both the theory and the practice.
Putting practice into theory.
Point out the failure of Earth People's Park is that there is no theory involved in that practice. They want to set up this practical plan. Perfect world can exist through practice, and the perfect world cannot exist through practice, but through practice and theory. You really have to know what you're doing.
But it really, that's
ex-DJ Bob Rudnick from WCLD.
But that's one of the things that we're able to do now, is to go around, because people, no matter where we go, people relate to us. They're starting to relate to us, because we're real. We are real revolutionaries. And when they see us as freaks doing our thing and putting theory into practice and running Marxism-Leninism at the same time, we're really turning people's heads around.
Show me Arguses.
Yeah.
Take them,
sure.
Ken Kelly.
What'd they say?
Sure, they're beautiful. They're beautiful.
Is that what they said?
Yeah.
I think.
You want to subscribe?
I think the party should at some time make some sort of stand, like on this thing about sabotage and terrorism and everything else. And from what I understand, that the level will be upped in terms of kidnappings and assassinations and all type of bombings with people in buildings, you know, after a while.